Welcome to the Cava Ships Podcast, where we try and cut through the fog and the murk, shine a bit of light on naval and maritime issues of the day. I'm Chris Cavas.
And I'm Chris Cervello.
The Cava Ships Podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is a trusted defense and technologies partner supporting all services in all domains and America's only builder of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. HII, delivering the advantage.
Coming up, author and scholar Nicholas Lambert joins us to discuss his newest work on Mahan and lessons from naval history and what it means for current events. But first, a look at naval news this week.
The U.S. Naval Air Systems Command on March 8th issued a flight clearance for the V-22 tilt-rotor Osprey aircraft, grounded after a late November accident in Japan killed 8 U.S. Air Force airmen. An Air Force-led investigation into the accident identified the material failure that led to the mishap, although the Pentagon did not reveal the specific failure. The aircraft is key to U.S. Marine Corps operations, particularly those of the service's 7 Marine Expeditionary Units, and is in the process of becoming the U.S. Navy's primary carrier onboard delivery, or COD, aircraft, operating with aircraft carriers at sea.
The White House on March 7th announced a U.S. effort to establish a temporary maritime pier in Gaza to provide greatly increased humanitarian aid to the war-torn region. While details still are being developed, it appears the U.S. military will deploy its Joint Logistics Over the Shore, or JLOTS, system to provide an expeditionary pier along the Gaza shoreline in the Mediterranean Sea. JLOTS, operated by the U.S. Navy and Army, allows ships to transfer cargo to smaller vessels for offloading cargo to a temporary causeway built for the purpose. According to the Pentagon, it will likely take several weeks to plan and execute the pier and system.
A Houthi anti-ship ballistic missile on March 6th struck the merchant ship True Confidence in the Gulf of Aden, killing 3 mariners and injuring at least 4 more, the first mariner fatalities since the Houthi began attacking merchant ships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden in November. The crew of the Liberian-owned Barbados-registered True Confidence abandoned ship and were rescued by the Indian destroyer Kolkata, while the True Confidence was last seen adrift and burning in the Gulf of Aden. And on March 9th, U.S. and coalition forces beat back what U.S. Central Command described as a large-scale attack by one-way attack drones in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, with ships and aircraft shooting down 15 drones.
The U.S. Sixth Fleet announced March 6th the Bataan Amphibious Ready Group with the 26th Marine Expeditionary Unit left the Mediterranean Sea and is returning to the U.S. East Coast. The group, including the amphibious ships Carter Hall and Mesa Verde, deployed in mid-July and was twice extended to provide a U.S. presence in the Eastern Mediterranean after the Hamas-Israel war broke out in October.
The U.S. destroyer John Finn carried out a transit of the Taiwan Strait on March 5th, the second U.S. surface transit of 2024, and the second in a row by the Japan-based U.S. destroyer. Meanwhile, China on March 7th announced it would raise its 2024 defense budget by 7.2%, the same amount it was raised in 2023. That yearly gain also follows a 7.1% increase in 2022.
U.S. Marine Corps Lieutenant General Karsten Heckel on March 7th confirmed the Pentagon's so-called pause on procurement of LPD landing ship dock amphibious ships is over. Speaking at a Capitol Hill event, Heckel said an effort to buy smaller, cheaper ships or cancel LPD production altogether was over. The Pentagon pause, announced in March 2023, followed 3 consecutive Department of Navy studies looking at LPD design alternatives, all of which reaffirmed plans to continue production of Flight II San Antonio-class LPDs.
And the British carrier HMS Queen Elizabeth on March 7th arrived in Scotland for dry docking and repairs to her starboard propeller shaft. Problems were discovered February 3rd, just before the carrier was to leave Portsmouth, England, for a series of extended exercises. HMS Prince of Wales, Britain's other aircraft carrier, is standing in for Queen Elizabeth on those exercises. And that's a look at just some of this week's Naval News.
All right. It is time for the discussion portion of the podcast. We are delighted to be joined by Nicholas Lambert. Nick is a scholar and an author. He was the class of 1957 chair at the U.S. Naval Academy from 2016 to 2018. His previous books include Sir John Fisher's Naval Revolution, Planning Armageddon, and The Warlords and Gallipoli Disaster. But we invited Nick to join us this week to talk about his newest book, The Neptune Factor, Alfred Thayer Mahan and the Concept of Sea Power. Nick, thank you very much for joining us this week.
Thank you for inviting me. I've been looking forward to this.
We were talking before we came on, and your book, I think, is very important. And some of your previous, some of the previous articles that you've written for USNI as well, talk about sea power. And so many navalists invoke the name of Alfred Thayer Mahan. They invoke this idea of sea power that they may or may not understand. What is sea power from your perspective, from Alfred Thayer Mahan's perspective? Give us sort of a baseline, and then we can talk a little bit about the man who coined the phrase and, you know, things that people know or don't know.
Really, Mahan is the first person to devise a coherent answer to the question, what is a Navy for? And his answer, of course, is sea power, a term and a concept that he coined. But it's important to understand that the operative word in sea power is the word power, not sea, as in whatever the Navy did on the sea had to relate directly to national power. So in during the 1890s, he did an amazing job at selling to Congress and the American people the importance of possessing a powerful Navy and how it really was a critical instrument of statecraft. 100 years ago, most people, or at least the ones that mattered, more or less understood what he meant by the term sea power. But since his death in 1914, however, I think Mahan's message has become garbled. And there are several reasons for this, and I'll just quickly mention just two. One is that his thoughts evolved and changed over time, which is to say, is you can't just simply read his first book, Influence of Sea Power Upon History, published in 1890, and think you get it all or understand all there is to know about sea power. Mahan continued to write, tweaking and polishing his sea power argument for another 17, arguably 24 years, depending on which metric you use. And then the second problem is, and here I'm going to use some technical academic jargon, so forgive me, is that Influence of Sea Power Upon History is really a hot mess, which makes it a very tough read. And actually, already more than one officer with stars on their shoulders has admitted to me that it's in fact, it was a great relief to learn that they were not being dumb for not really understanding the book. And why is this? It would be, well, for his first major book, he's attempting far too much. He's just not a good enough writer or experienced enough scholar. And I speak from some experience in this, in that I attempted something far less ambitious than Mahan did with my first book. And really, there are many things that I wished I had said differently. Anyway, back to the point about influence, is that influence is riddled with these structural flaws and contradictions in argument and poor writing. And when you read it, as I'm sure you have, tell me if you agree. Some arguments you are just crystal clear and timeless, and others are, should we say, rather more opaque. Does that make sense to what I'm saying?
It does to me. I mean, I read it at the Naval Academy and definitely struggled, and then tried to read it again, thinking that it was just my immature mind at the time why I couldn't understand it, and I found the same difficulty as well. So I'm not surprised to hear that.
Yeah, and he doesn't make it easy. So it's often said, for instance, that Mahan was utterly opposed to commerce warfare, or Goethe course, as people often say. Well, yes and no, or should I say wrong and right. Actually, he thought the purpose of a navy was really all about commerce, especially in war, but also in peace. But he was indeed totally opposed to Goethe course. Now, you may think that's a contradiction, but you can in fact reconcile this, and really quite easily. But what you'd have to know is that what he meant by certain phrases, such as Goethe course, which I explain in the book. And of course, it doesn't help either that his former CO and his patron in the Navy, Stephen Luce, is really riding his back, pushing him to include material that, or make certain arguments that Mahan really didn't want to do. Over time, as I say, you've got to go beyond. Time doesn't stop in 1890 for Mahan. So over time, Mahan increasingly sees or defines sea power as less about combat and more about economics and commerce. And in fact, during the early 1900s, he flat out says sea power is more about commerce than combat, which is not to say that combat's unimportant. Rather, one must contemplate the purpose of combat. You may have noticed he's using this phrase recurs in a lot of what he writes, which I'm sure you recognize. He's talking about the sterile glory of fighting battles merely to win them. And his prime example here was the frigate actions during the War of 1812. Mahan says they had absolutely no impact on the course of the war. I mean, none. But you will appreciate that when he's making this argument, he's standing on very thin ice, because at the time, these frigate actions, of course, are celebrated as the US Navy's finest achievements. And when he's saying this, it sounds like he's denigrating the achievements of the Navy, and which makes a lot of people very angry.
Why then is Mahan, and why has sea power been bastardized to sort of view this combat at sea, this battleship mentality, I mean, when did that begin to happen in the interpretation of Mahan?
Well, there's actually several questions, or you've got a couple of questions in one there, in that why is that he found that there is the tendency amongst naval officers to focus on the combat. And he's saying is that's not enough. He says that, in many ways, this is his central message. Is you don't over you cannot overfocus on combat, and I suppose you would add procurement into this. It is absolutely essential for officers and policymakers to think about their profession on a higher plane, to lift their horizons, to contemplate today what falls under the category of strategy, I suppose. But I suppose strategy, of course, is very difficult to define precisely. Perhaps it would be better if I said that Mahan wanted the Navy to think more on the purpose and political object behind the naval action. Yeah, rather than just exclusively on the operational or tactical problems of the moment. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense to me. It's troubling to me though, and we talked about this again. I mean, we continue to see this sort of false, I don't know if it's false bravado or misunderstanding, as the Navy constantly wants to define itself as a war fighting first service, that it wants to be all about war fighters and war fighting, and they continue to miss that higher purpose of the Navy that Mahan was trying to drive at.
Yeah, and that you're exactly right. And in fact, you can't really understand what the Navy's about and what you're doing and how to go about doing it unless you understand what the higher purpose is. And I think it's fair to say that Mahan's central message is just as true today as it was 100 years ago, in that the Navy like to say they're committed to sea power, but they really don't like dealing with the economic aspects of the subject. I think the Navy, or many people in the Navy, would be much happier with their lot in life if they could get a divorce from this economic stuff. I think indeed many seem to think that back in 1954, Sam Huntington granted the Navy its divorce with his famous Transoceanic Navy article. Sorry to say, the reality is, and whether they like it or not, the Navy is firmly married to the international economics. Or international economic system, both in peace and in war. And there's just no getting out of it. And the fact is that the received strategic wisdom from Huntington, although brilliant at the time, is just out of date. The whole policy recommendations that he makes, talking about prior projection, which is in a sense prescribing its rationale, are built upon a set of assumptions that just no longer are true. And yet, although the world has changed and these underpinning assumptions behind the entire rationale for proper force projection, this but despite the fact they're out of date, is that it still dominates so many people's thinking about what the Navy's supposed to do. And I would argue it goes beyond that, and it informs the understanding, the Navy's place within joint doctrine. I think we're threatening to get into very deep waters here. I'll stop there for the moment.
So if I could get in, I mean, there are so many levels to all this.
Yes.
I think one of the fundamental aspects, and you're already hitting it right from the beginning, is strategic thought versus tactical thought.
Yes.
And, you know, what are we doing in the big picture? What are we doing in the smaller picture to enable the big picture?
Yes.
And the problem is the tactical side of it, the up close and personal, is a far easier to understand story.
Yes.
So even, you know, people who, you know, have spent their whole lives reading naval history, you start off reading about battles, yes, you know, specific ships, specific fleets, and Nelson and Isaac Hull and all this stuff, and Old Ironsides, and isn't it cool, and you know, actions in World War II. And at some point, you begin to graduate from that, and you get into the bigger picture of what are we talking about. I think it's interesting that, you know, you talk, you know, Mahan is talking about an earlier time. He's writing in the 1890s, but he's writing about the 17th century and the 18th century, and things were slower. You didn't have this speed. So you had time for strategic thought. Everything was this big, slow-moving picture that didn't give you an instant response. And there might have been a deep, especially in the higher echelons of the Admiralty and things like that, a deeper appreciation of the bigger picture, what we're doing. We may be losing this frigate actions. You know, the Serapis gets captured by the Americans off Flamborough Head, and John Paul Jones is a hero, except that the whole convoy got away.
Yep.
So, you know, who won the battle? Well, the convoy got away. The convoy was the target, not the Serapis. And on and on. Today we have, you know, the Red Sea. We have all these actions going on in the Red Sea, and destroyers front and center in a almost instant response situation, where, you know, the world is aware of these actions quite quickly. But they're not combating Houthi UAVs or USVs or anti-ballistic missiles. They're trying to enable the continuing passage of merchant shipping. And that's the sea power aspect. It's not the destroyer fighting. It's the merchant ships clogging through the Red Sea, clogging through the Suez Canal, clogging around Africa, clogging around everywhere. That's sea power, but it's not sexy, and it doesn't happen fast. And I can't take a quick picture of it and go, look, it's cool. But the lessons of Mahan are that this much more widely diffuse issue here, that's from sea power.
Yeah.
I
was just going to agree with you and just go one step further. I think the real mission in the Red Sea is the free flow of commerce. Yeah. The problem is the way the Navy is going about it, it seems to me they're interpreting it as the protection of merchant ships. And that's not at all the same thing.
They're also trying to sell the Navy. And, you know, there is this aspect of, you know, strategic thought is all well and good. And it underpins everything. And you want the smart people to be doing that. But I can't sell that to the Congress really fast. They don't buy it. They don't see it. They don't get it. They're busy people. They have 374 things to pay attention to today. So you got to give them something they can eat real fast.
Mahan's telling you how to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, sea power is really about economics and commerce. And so how is it he's so successful and they're listening to him? And that's because he's talking their language, which is business and commerce. And he says it's absolutely central to it. And this is something that the Navy leadership doesn't seem to want to do today. They don't want to deal with the economics and the commerce. Yeah, in plain, simple language.
Sure.
But that's what most Americans are interested in, their livelihoods, their business, their profits, whatever it is. That's what their life's all about. All our life's about, right? So the most important influence of what we do is basically linked to economics. And there's Mahan saying this, but the Navy is right at the center of all this.
Well, we've tried. It's interesting because in the 20 years that I was in the Navy, the Navy has tried numerous times to convince itself to have that deeper, more thoughtful discussion. And then it gets bored with its own rhetoric and it moves on before the audience moves on. So, I mean, you saw it in a conversation or the national conversation with the country, where they talked about the maritime strategy. You saw it in the 80s, with the maritime strategy of the 80s. You've seen it elsewhere, whereas the uniform folks get bored talking about it because they believe that they need to talk war fighting and not the sort of the larger purpose of the Navy. I do wonder, though, if you can do both. I think you can do both. I think you can have a sea power discussion and highlight tactical successes that help you sell programs and products and things that you need for your Navy, and that the two don't have to be divorced. I wonder what you think.
I agree. I mean, I have met quite a number of officers who really do get it and understand. They quite understand the importance of economic, but for whatever reason, they're certainly not in the majority. And like you say, something can come along and distract them or derail them. Or it's just simply a matter of turnover in assignments. The other thing I would say is that it really requires, however, I think, for someone to have the if you're going to do this, you and Mahan deals with this question as well. You've got to be prepared to leave your own comfort zone of your own expertise, which is naval combat. I mean, you've been trained to do that, right? That's what you're the expert at. But if you're going to be dealing with strategy, this means you've got to step out of your combat, your comfort zone, and you've got to be dealing with, people from the Treasury, from Commerce Department, from Agriculture, any other agencies, an infinite number of agencies. And whereby you're going to be dealing with subjects you're not completely familiar with, or they know more than you. And that's not easy to do. But there are a number of officers who can do it. But at the same time, there doesn't seem to be a broader understanding of what sea power is about, or if you prefer, there doesn't seem to be any more an understanding of just how important the maritime domain is. And for that, you can go back to, Sam Huntington, the article I was talking about. Since then, everybody has always thought that the sea is a subsidiary of the land, because what really, on land is where it really happens, and that's where you get decisive results. You only achieve decisive results on land, but Mahan is saying that's not true. He says two things. He says, one, the sea is a completely separate domain, and in fact, through economic coercion or interdiction, regulation of commercial activity on the sea, you can generate significant economic pressure that can achieve your sufficient to achieve your national objectives and persuade the other guy to stop doing what he's doing. But you've got to have the understanding and the willingness to use it.
Let me tee up a subject, and then I think Chris will piggyback on it. The Navy, especially in the last, I would say 30 years, maybe even more than that, has become, though, known, if only to itself, but I would say across the joint force, as the 911 force, the Navy and the Marine Corps together. And what I mean by that is they're forward deployed, they're out there doing sea power type missions. But when something happens, when there's a crisis, like the president last night talked about, a need to whether do something in the Red Sea or do something additionally for humanitarian purposes, the nation's leaders look to the Navy to do that. How do you reconcile the two roles? Is it a secondary role? Is it a beneficiary role? Or does it work against sea power to be that 911 force?
I think it really depends on the context. As a, if you're talking about dealing with all-out war, yes, then the Navy is definitely the back seat. It's the glorified ferry service to get the Army or the Air Force to get them to where they want to get to and hit the enemy on the land. Which, as I say, I don't agree with that characterization at all. But anyway, that does seem to underpin a lot of assumptions. But when you're talking about in peacetime operations, as it were, or counterinsurgency, then yes, the Navy tend and the Marine Corps tend to be seen as the kind of glorified fire brigade.
Right.
So if a house is burning down, you send the fire brigade. But if the whole damn city is burning down, well, then that gets taken out of the Navy's hands, and it becomes a national level problem where you have the I don't know, you default to the perspective that really what happens of its significance is on land. And again, it seems to have been forgotten. And I know I'm repeating myself here, is that you can, I mean, if you choke, gets up your chokehold of someone's economy, yeah, you've got their attention. I mean, put it this way, if you cut off my scotch, my chocolate, and my coffee, you've certainly got my attention. Yeah. And in a sense, that's what you've got to do to the other side. Because invariably, most of those commodities, the scotch, the coffee, and the chocolate, come from overseas, which means they got here on a ship.
In the time we have left, it's always been an interesting aspect of Mahan that his influence on foreign navies, foreign countries, has been immense. It was almost immediate when his book came out, was widely read around the world, widely read in Europe, widely digested in Imperial Japan at the time. It underpinned the investment in Japan for a larger navy and their partnership with the British. And anyway, it seems to me that one of the more significant elements consuming Mahan today are the Chinese. That, you know, 25 years ago, we had a pretty backward, not modern, not up to date, not expanding Chinese Navy that nobody was terribly worried about. And then they realized that this was an instrument of sea power element, an instrument of sea power that would lead to world power. And they've embarked on one of the largest naval expansions that history has ever seen. And it's a balanced fleet. It's not, you know, concentrated on certain aspects of sea power. They're essentially building a modern U.S. Navy with Chinese characteristics, but very Mahanian. Would you agree with that? I mean, when you look at what the Chinese have been doing since the last 25 years, do you see Mahan in that?
Yes, no, up to a point. I mean, the real question is, and I don't know the answer, I'm not sure anybody else does either, at least over here, is how do they envision using their fleet? What's the precise mechanism of coercion they envision when they were their navy? So back in the 1890s, as you say, a lot of people instantly latch on to what Mahan is saying, as I said, because it's a really coherent explanation of why, what navies are for and why it matters. But you've got to remember, is this is the first, this is just the beginnings of the first period of globalization, when businesses, you've got supply chains starting to stretch around the world. Yes, you've got businesses transacting. Sorry, I don't want to go into too much of the history of globalization, because I know we're running out of time. But it's the first era of globalization, and therefore, what happens on the sea matters a great deal more than it had been in an earlier era. And more countries are participating, or if you like, are stakeholders in the smooth running of the globalized economic system. And this is, by the way, what Mahan really did see and understand. You know, he's one of the, he is the first student of globalization, in a sense. He's, you know, it's not clear, because it wasn't clear back then. This is what, we didn't have the word back then. We didn't have the word arguably until the 80s. But he's looking at the strategic implications of what this really means. And actually, his conclusion is that more and more advanced industrial societies are increasingly dependent upon access to the common, as he called it. Yeah. Right. And if you interdict their access to the common, you can, in fact, generate significant pressure on that state. Hence sea power. You know, it isn't a playbook for greatness. It's really just illustrating the broader point, is that what happens on the sea matters. It's a separate domain. Again, I probably would need hours to elaborate. And anyway, I wrote the book, so you can, if you're interested, you can sort of fill in the dots there. But so the second part of the question, yes, I think I'll say what I initially said. I'll just double down there and say it really depends on how the Chinese envision, what they imagine the mechanism of pressure is. I'm not sure geography is completely on their side to do the sort of things that the UK used to do and what the US is capable of doing.
We are going to have to leave it there, Nick. I really appreciate, as I said at the top, that this is a fascinating discussion. I would encourage our listeners to go out and get a copy of The Neptune Factor. In the meantime, though, you can go to the Defense and Aerospace Report website. Friend of the pod, Steve Deal, wrote a really good book review and talked about how some of these themes and the things that he learned in the Neptune Factor played into his growth as a naval officer. Steve's piece is called A Prophet of Power for Our Times. And as I said, it's on the Defense and Aerospace Report website. We've been talking to Nicholas Lambert. Nick is a noted academic and scholar and author of the Neptune Factor. Nick, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks. I wish it had been a couple of hours longer.
And now a new occasional feature on the podcast, a focused comment from a significant person about a significant topic. Earlier this week, I attended a two-day conference sponsored by ASNI, the American Society of Naval Engineers, on Arctic operations, and had a chance to speak with Admiral Darrell Caudle, commander of U.S. Fleet Forces Command. Admiral Caudle, by the way, was preparing to fly to the North Pole directly after attending the conference. I asked him a rather detailed question about the role of the different services in the Arctic. I apologize here because there were some distraction noises in the background as we spoke, but I thought Admiral Caudle's comments are worth listening to, including his remarks about the possible need for a specific Arctic office.
One of the perennial misunderstandings is every year there's hearings, and there's various hearings with various committees in different houses. It doesn't really matter. And that people don't break out whose role is what in the Arctic. There's a general assumption that everything must be the Navy. People are always asking some admiral about how come you don't have any icebreakers.
Yeah.
Well, we don't do that anymore.
Yes.
There's all that. There's also the fact that the Air Force has an immense homeland defense responsibility up there, that more fifth-generation fighters are based in Alaska than anywhere else in the world.
Yes.
And nobody ever talks about that in terms of combat capability.
No. Not widely.
I'm sorry?
Not widely. Yeah, it's shared between NORTHCOM and INDOPACOM, too. And INDOPACOM, actually, those forces are assigned to INDOPACOM. Interesting enough.
Yet, that makes an enormous difference in the calculation about what we're talking about and who does what.
That's right.
So just kind of briefly, can you go through from your point of mind, and you wear all these different hats.
You cross
all these different borders.
Yes.
And you're a submariner.
Yes.
So, you know, long history and certainly in surveillance and under ice operations and preparing to go to war against Soviet missile submarine bastions in the Arctic, all this. Break out a bit how you see the different responsibilities. The Navy doesn't have ice-capable surface ships. The Coast Guard sort of does and would like some more.
Yeah.
There's a lot of aircraft up there. There's submarine ISR.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you see the breakout, and that what should people be thinking about in terms of different services and how they fit into this pie?
Yeah. Well, I think to your point about who's the lead service, if you will, I do think that is the Navy. I think we're the lead because it is the Arctic Sea. You know, it is a body of water up there that's got a lot of ice on it that's frozen and is melting to the extent it's melting each year. So from the standpoint of like the preponderance of mission, I see Navy and Coast Guard being that, I think so from a service perspective. Now, I mentioned about the personnel recovery piece in my remarks. That's certainly got, Air Forces, Naval Air Forces and U.S. Air Forces attention. It should have their attention because, to get folks in that environment is extremely hard and limits our peacetime, I think, concepts of operation. The risk that NORTHCOM would be willing to take to go meet Russian, long-range aviation over the North Pole, he's got to be thinking about how he recovers the pilots to go do that. So there's work that needs to be done in personnel recovery for sure. I think we're best. I don't know that I can answer your question, give you a complete breakdown, but I think we're best when a mission is assigned in general to what we call in the Navy a type commander. And so the type, kind of gets the preponderance of the mission, has to work with others, of course. And then that ties the type commander to the fleet commander, who actually owns the operational risk, okay? And then the type commanders, the way we work in the Navy, have a relationship already with a resource sponsor on one side and an acquisition team on the other side. So that if you can get it aligned correctly in the fleet structure, then I get the acquisition connective tissue and the resource sponsor connective tissue by extension. So today, most of that lands with the submarine force, as you mentioned. So it lives predominantly with submarine forces and the resource sponsors N97 for that, OPNAV N97. And the development of doctrine for the Arctic falls under Undersea Warfare Development Center, who owns the Arctic submarine lab, where ICE pilots are, and that's where they're home in San Diego. So a lot of that mission set, because so much of this near ice, marginal ice zone, under ice, falls to the submarine force because we don't have icebreakers. That's why that's landed that way. Is that correct? Does that get after the total picture? No, it does not. It doesn't. And so what happens, and it's a little bit like counter UAS is another example. You know, you can have these same type of mission sets that don't naturally align. In other words, it's a problem for everybody. And when you got a problem for everybody, it doesn't tend to line up in that structure that I just said works very well. So then you have to have, typically what we do in those cases is establish an office. So, you know, maybe an office for innovation, an office for rapid capability development. So do we need an Arctic office? An office that would basically help bridge the disparate mission sets, utilizing the one that has a preponderance of the mission as the kind of the example, you know, the way it kind of runs it, but has this office that helps echelon one, you know, think about, you know, the things you've discussed across mission sets.
Would you advocate for that?
I think we need it, yeah. I would advocate for that. I think it's important because, again, we don't, you know, Department of Defense usually doesn't like insurance policies, as we know. And, you know, we talk about, you know, what's the 9/11 event to get everybody to kind of think about what's going on here. I'm trying to, you know, really in the last couple of years been campaigning hard on the Arctic because I see this as a little bit of a blind spot, I believe, to the public. You know, I get a lot of from you guys even like, why is the Arctic important? What are you talking about? Who's even up there? What's going on? So I think the threat's not widely understood. I think what Russia and China are, you know, would like to see done up there is not widely understood. It's a place that we frequently don't see deployments made to because it's a lot of subsurface stuff. So that typically that story goes untold. And so when you don't see the main naval forces, aircraft carrier and support ships, crewed as operating in those high latitudes, then it's not, a lot of times, not on the radar.
Well, thank you, Chris, and thank you, Admiral Caudill. That does it for this week. As always, our thanks go out to Vago Maradian and the Defense and Aerospace Group for their support.
The Cavendish Ships Podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is the designer and operator of the U.S. Navy's live virtual constructive training enterprise, the largest LVC enterprise in the U.S. Department of Defense. HII, delivering the advantage.
Be sure to follow us at Cavis Ships on Twitter. And remember, this podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Cervello.
And I'm Chris Cavis. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye.